morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Coming up today, we're going to talk about an effort in Tallahassee to limit the constitutional amendment that was just passed to raise the minimum wage gradually over the next 5 years. We're going to talk about that and more about the state legislature. Later on, we'll open up the phone lines. First, several listener comments that have come in the last 24 hours. One comment about whether or not the Capitol Police did the right thing at the insurrection at the Capitol. Another comment about the sanctions that were voted against the conspiracy theory believing Congresswoman. And we'll also talk about the governor trying to get a law passed to crack down on politicians who post conspiracy theories and threats of violence. And one more comment about the Super Bowl. Here's what four listeners have had to say.
This is Clark in Sarasota. There's a fellow yesterday that talked about why the police force at the Capitol and all that maybe had decided not to bring in the National Guard because situations that happened at the Black Lives Matter, which seemed to me as a little dishonesty in that if they were doing it, because they could have brought in the National Guard and had them really on the outskirts, not even appearing anywhere, and easily brought them in at the last minute. So I don't know if it's really the Black Lives Matter thing that really was it. They could have handled that very easily without incurring any trouble.
This is Barbara from Sarasota, and in regards to Teresa's call, I think if the GOP retaliates because of Green being stripped of her committee positions, then I think our leaders would stop leading because of fear, and I think that would be wrong.
Hi, this is Jeff from New Tampa. On the show, one listener pointed out that private companies have the power to censor whoever they choose to. So this is true. Overall, I don't like censorship. You may be happy when somebody you don't like gets censored, but eventually that censorship might come around to somebody you like or even you. So the answer to speech that you don't like is better speech.
Hey, this is Kevin in Bradenton. Want to leave a message about today's show. We were talking about the Super Bowl and the price of the tickets. Well, I want to mention that there is so many millions of dollars gambled on this game. There's thousands of dollars bet on whether or not the coin flip will come up heads or tails. And the point I'm trying to make here is in other states, in other countries that have legalized sports betting, they actually tax it. They regulate it. And it's actually more legitimate when that happens. And so the reasons that they consider not doing it, I don't understand. The suits in Tallahassee must realize that we need more revenue. And this is becoming very popular all across the country. And I will also say this, for those of us that think that the lottery is some form of gambling that can take the place of sports betting, I will tell you this, that if you think you have a chance to win and the odds are 14 million to one, I've got a piece of property for you in southern Florida. Bring your wading boots. But that's not gambling, and we should have actual legal sports betting and legal recreational weed.
Those were some listener comments that came in after yesterday's program. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. A state senator from Pinellas County, Jeff Brandis, is looking to alter Florida's newly adopted $15 an hour minimum wage mandate. That's the constitutional amendment that was overwhelmingly passed by voters last year to gradually raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour by the year 2026. Senate Judiciary Chairman Jeff Brandis of St. Petersburg, a Republican, says his proposal to amend the state constitution to allow the legislature to exempt convicted felons and people under 21 from new minimum wage requirements would help them get jobs in the future. We're going to talk today with Dr. Rich Templin. He's the Director of Politics and Public Policy for the Florida AFL-CIO. And we're going to talk with him about the proposal to limit the constitutional amendment that raised the minimum wage. Rich Templin, thanks for coming on WMNF today.
Yes, sir. Thank you. One of our most important radio sources in Florida.
Well, thanks for saying that. Let me ask you about the minimum wage. There's a proposal in Tallahassee to alter the amendment that voters just passed in November to raise the minimum wage gradually over the next 5 years. Tell us about the proposal.
Well, I mean, first off, I think it's important to preface that, you know, there's already been an incredible amount of cynicism around this. And that cynicism is born from the fact that every time the voters approve changes to the Constitution, even if those changes don't really require legislative action, the legislature always kind of goes in after the fact and monkeys with it. And they see it, we then have to go to court and there's a lot of expenses. And, you know, and we saw that with Amendment 4. Allowing former felons returning citizens to vote. But I do think that, you know, we should at least take the sponsor at their word a little bit that they're trying to do something beneficial for sectors of the workforce. It's just not the right step, right? So, you know, the voters approved a $15 minimum wage that will be phased in over time. That $15 is still not a living wage in many of our communities across the state, but it's getting closer. And carving out and saying that different sectors of the workforce should not be able to enjoy that right to a closer to living wage is really just the wrong way to go. For example, returning citizens, former felons, people with a record would not be able to have a near living wage. Well, they're the ones who need it the most. I mean, one of the biggest reasons for recidivism is poverty and the ability to earn a living. So instead of carving them out of that, why not have a statewide, you know, kind of ban the box statute that will eliminate that discrimination that these workers face. When we talk about workers with physical or mental challenges, again, why should they be carved out of what is now a fundamental right in our Constitution? Why not increase funding for job training, job placement? I mean, these are all ways that we can get these sectors of the workforce employed that don't involve taking away what we believe and what the voters have said is a fundamental right in our Constitution.
Yeah. Well, Jeff Brandis, who's the state senator from St. Petersburg, has this idea, as you just outlined. He doesn't want to pay the minimum wage to people that are under 21, to ex-felons, and a group that he calls hard-to-hire employees, which I've worked in a lot of places in my years. There's a lot of really tough employees in many businesses and companies and nonprofits around the state. I don't know what the senator means by hard to hire employees.
Well, that's a big problem just in terms of the construction of the amendment that he wants to put on the ballot. There is no definition of hard to hire. I think there's probably a lot of people here in Tallahassee in the legislative process that would consider me hard to hire. that is a big problem, is that there is no definition of that. That would require the legislature to come back were this amendment to pass and then provide that legal definition of hard to hire. And then with that, they could dramatically increase the number of people who don't enjoy this fundamental right to a near living wage. Now when it comes to people under 21, I mean, this is a common assumption that lawmakers around the country have had for a long time. It's a wrong assumption. And that is that workers under 21 are, you know, teenagers, college students, working fast food to make money for the summer, you know, what have you. The bottom line is there are a lot of people out there under the age of 21 who are primary breadwinners, who have families to provide for, who aren't just simply working between college semesters, and so that just really reflects a lack of understanding about what the minimum wage workforce looks like today.
Yeah, but I think Senator Brandis says, he thinks that these are all kind of middle class kids who have summer jobs.
Right.
And I guess what might be forgotten is that a lot of people just go to high school, they graduate, or maybe don't graduate, and then go into the workforce, and then they've got to pay their rent, pay for their car. If they have kids, they got to pay for the kids or child care.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so that's forgotten. But, I mean, in a sense, is Brandis trying to create a permanent underclass? That is, the underclass would be people who are ex-felons, who are under 21, who are hard-to-hire employees. And these folks would never, never, by the year 2026, be eligible for $30,000 a year. They'd all be paid less because the employer could pay them less.
Right. I mean, it's a legally constructed, kind of stratification of society that's just not needed. There are many other ways that we can, approach this problem of people that have increased difficulties in finding employment, and relegating them to a lower tier, a lower status for perhaps the rest of their lives. It's just not an answer. And again, organizations that supported Amendment 2 have been waiting week after week to see what the legislature was going to do to somehow weaken that amendment. I mean, this is an expectation that is widely held. And so when this proposal comes out, of course, everybody feels justified, like, okay, as usual, the legislature's not going to simply listen to the will of the voters. They're going to go in and try to change it. So there's a lot of cynicism around it. But, at this point, I think we should take the senator at his word. And I think that we should all be communicating with our lawmakers about how there might be a good intention here, but it's just the wrong approach.
Was the minimum wage amendment ambiguous? That is, did it allow for loopholes or exceptions?
It was not constructed in that way. And I think any simple reading of it doesn't find that there's any need for legislative action or implementation statutes. But again, we've had this argument with the legislature, many, many times. Right. I mean, I think we would argue that the constitutional amendment is self-implementing. We argued when the first minimum wage constitutional amendment passed that it didn't require any legislative implementation. They still tried. They were unsuccessful in that manner. And so this is a little different because it's not changing statute. It is fundamentally changing the Constitution. But the sentiment there is still the same.
Mm. Rich Templin is our guest, and he's a spokesperson for the Florida AFL-CIO, and this is WMNF in Tampa. Rich is in Tallahassee. So, Rich, let's go back a few years. A few years ago, Floridians did vote for another minimum wage increase. Our minimum wage is set slightly higher than the national minimum wage. And I remember talking with Mark Wilson of the Florida Chamber of Commerce up there in Tallahassee where you are. And Mark, back during the previous debate, warned that we would see higher unemployment because Florida employers would now have to pay about a dollar or so above the national minimum wage rate. What happened after we raised the minimum wage the last time?
I'll even go one further. The advertising campaign that Mark Wilson and the Florida Chamber of Commerce engaged in, this was back in 2004, when we suffered repeated hits by major hurricanes, and their ad campaign was another hurricane is coming, and that was the minimum wage amendment, and none of the gloom and doom that they predicted has actually happened. The funny thing is that we've actually seen a $15 an hour minimum wage implemented in different places. Seattle is a great example. And what we saw in Seattle was there was, and you know, we have to be honest about this stuff, or at least I feel like we do, as someone who's really interested in finding good public policy. But we did see in the beginning a slight decline, not necessarily in employment, but the number of hours that were being assigned to employees, what have you. But over time, that quickly rebounded, and now we're seeing higher employment, we're seeing more economic activity, and that $15 an hour minimum wage has been a smashing success. I mean, the bottom line is, especially in Florida, where so much of our economic activity is consumer behavior, the more money that you put in people's pockets, especially those at the lower end of the earning scale, the more money is pumped into local businesses, the more money that's pumped into local cash registers. And it really is a tide that lifts all boats. Interestingly enough, 78% of all the state revenue, the general revenue, what they call GR, and that's what funds all of the different programs and social safety net programs and such that the state has, is paid by the sales and use tax. Now, that's a really regressive tax structure, but, you know, that's for another discussion. But because so much of our revenue is derived from consumer behavior, people purchasing things at cash registers, this is really going to be a boon for the state as well. So all of these predictions of gloom and doom, they didn't come true in Seattle. They didn't come true in Florida when we raised the minimum wage before. And they're just not going to come true now.
And did businesses close down? Did we see a raft of businesses close down after the 2004 minimum wage increase?
No, the 2004 increase was met with, it resulted in actually a better business and economic climate than one that was, that was reduced.
Rich, I got to ask you about a couple more things. First of all, are farm workers covered by the minimum wage here in Florida?
It depends. It's in some cases, yes. In some cases, no. I'm not exactly sure under this amendment. You know, a lot of us here in Tallahassee do our best, because we do have to do special advocacy for this important part of our economy and this important labor sector. So I'm not exactly sure how the $15 will be applied in the agricultural setting. Mm.
A supermajority would have to approve Senator Brandis's call for limits on the minimum wage. A supermajority of the legislature would have to approve his call. How far along is this proposal up there in Tallahassee? But where does it stand right now?
Well, constitutional, putting a legislative referred constitutional amendment on the ballot requires a 3/5 vote in both chambers. I don't believe at this point that there's enough interest, at least on the Senate side, to meet that threshold. But again, I mean, the session hasn't even started. Now, you wouldn't know that to look at the legislature, who is quickly ramming through, especially on the Senate side. They are just quickly ramming through major, major changes in public policy, most of which are very controversial. And they're doing so under the cover of COVID, because people can't travel to Tallahassee right now. You're not allowed to, you know, people aren't allowed into the committee rooms. They have to address their legislators remotely. And so everything is moving much faster than we've ever seen before. But at this early stage with this particular proposal right now, it doesn't look like the interest is there to pass it, but it's still something that needs to be discussed really seriously, which is, you know, why it's a great opportunity to come on your program and talk to your listeners about it.
And even though the legislature doesn't officially begin its session until March, about a month away, the committees are meeting and the subcommittees are meeting, and they're deciding the fate of a lot of legislation. That's what you're getting at.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we saw, not to get off the topic of the constitutional amendment and the minimum wage, but we saw a major, major change to the Florida retirement system passed through its first committee yesterday with almost no testimony. Folks that were there to explain this complex change were limited to 2.5 minutes. And the required actuarial study of this change, there's a law that says they've got to know the numbers of how this is going to impact the Florida retirement system. They don't even have that study yet. And so they passed it basically in the dark, not knowing what it does, and not really willing to hear from the stakeholders in the Florida retirement system.
And this is
what we're seeing.
This is the proposal to say, as of July 1st of next year, any new state employee would no longer be eligible for the defined benefit pension plan the state has run for years. They would have to join a 401k plan. And
right.
It would begin the phase out, I gather, of the defined pension plan for government employees.
Right. I mean, what happens is once you over 70% of Florida's pension plan, which is it's rated one of the best in the country consistently, but over 70% of the money in that fund comes from the investments themselves. The taxpayers in the state is only on the hook for, under a quarter of that. And so by shutting down new people coming into the pension fund, what that does is it drives up costs to the state and to the taxpayers. We saw this back in 2011 when they tried to do the same thing. And their own actuarial analysis, and again, we don't have it yet this year, but their own actuarial analysis at the time said that, in the first year it was going to cost taxpayers an extra $150 million. In the second year, $300 million. In the third year, $450 million. And that number continues to grow for about 8 or 9 years going out. And so the legislature, we were able to stop the legislature from moving on that really bad idea. But this is just another case where there's an ideology out there that doesn't believe in pensions. They believe that everybody should be in the stock market. That ideology is what's driving this. There's no facts to support it.
Our guest is Rich Templin. He's with the Florida AFL-CIO. He's based in Tallahassee, and this is WMNF 88.5 FM. So I read, though, one of the pushbacks on this to try to get all state employees into a 401k is that the current system has a $36 billion unmet obligation. That's what one of the backers of this idea said to one of the reporters up there yesterday in Tallahassee, that you've got a shortfall. So is that true? And how do you make up the shortfall if it's true?
It's the verbiage that is not true. So when you call that $36 billion a shortfall, think of a pension fund like your mortgage, right? Florida's pension fund is over 80% funded. That 20% that is not funded, well, actually it's less than 20% that is not funded, is called the unfunded actuarial liability, right, the UAL. So what this means is if you're living in your home and 80% of your home is paid off, that's not a bad thing. You're doing quite well. It only matters if the bank shows up one day and says, you've got to pay this other 20% right now. That $36 billion is only a shortfall if every single person in the state retired on the same day at the same time. And of course, that's never going to happen. As long as you are over 80% funded, and we are, you are considered in good shape. So they talk about that as a deficit or as a shortfall, but it's not. It's just the amount on the mortgage that has yet to be paid. And there's no reason to assume that those payments won't be able to be met in the future.
So teachers, firefighters, police, all state employees.
And municipal employees, too. A lot of people don't realize that many county and city governments are also invested in the Florida retirement system. That is where their employees have their retirement plan. So it's much bigger than that. And really, Florida's interesting because you don't retire from service in Florida and move to Ohio or Pennsylvania. You stay here. And so we see that for every $1, and this was an AARP study, for every $1 in pension payouts generates $6.67 in economic activity. So when they're messing with this, I mean, what they're messing with, you know, that $6.67, I mean, that generates $18.2 billion in economic impact in the state. So they're not just messing with a retirement system. They're messing with a major pillar of Florida's overall economy.
Do existing employees have anything to worry about? I mean, if you're a teacher or a municipal employee or work for county government, and this thing passes.
Well, if this legislation passes, there will be no direct impact on current retirees or those that are in the system and close to vesting, what have you. But the impact is that by refusing to let new people join the pool, you're putting the entire system on a road to collapse. And that's what people need to be concerned about, is that by doing this, we are going to exponentially drive up the cost to the taxpayers. And that puts the whole fund at risk. So it's the future payouts to retirees that we are also very concerned about. I mean, the bottom line is we have a great system. We have seen an increase in that unfunded actuarial liability. But much of that increase has been because of the legislature. The legislature has done different things over the years to weaken the fund so that they could get to a place where they believe they are today, where they can say, oh, we just can't afford the pension anymore. And that's just fundamentally inaccurate.
Rich, one last question. That is, recently there's new management at the Florida Democratic Party, and the staff last year organized into the IBEW, into Local 824. They formed a union at the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party just laid off most of the staff, and most of those people who had laid off, about 15 people or so, are members of the bargaining unit, are members of Local 824. So is the Florida Democratic Party anti-union?
I don't believe they're anti-union. And I'm aware of everything that you just shared. What I'm not aware of are the specific negotiations that they had, that the Florida Democratic Party had with IBEW Local 824. That's really where you need to look. Because, you know, it could be, and again, I haven't seen the deal that was negotiated about this separation, but, you know, it could be that the management of the party and the local union negotiated well and worked well together. I really don't know the answer to that.
All right. Well, Rich, let me ask you, is there anything else? I mean, the legislative session is really important. A lot of people, because we're so far away from Tallahassee, don't pay close attention. I think everybody should pay close attention, but tell us what else you'd like to emphasize as we close out this interview.
There are a lot of major issues that the legislature, especially the Florida Senate, which we've never seen before. The Florida Senate is usually much more slow, deliberate, with a real focus on policy. Right now, we're seeing a Florida Senate that is not being deliberate, is not really carefully weighing the policy options in front of them, and they're really pushing forward at breakneck speed based on ideology. For example, there's another issue that is moving very quickly through the process, and that's blanket immunity for corporations because of deaths, injury, what have you, from COVID. And their, you know, their line is that, you know, this is good for the business community because they need to know that they're not going to be subject to frivolous lawsuits. They didn't do anything wrong. Well, there was a viral video yesterday and the day before of a grocery store in Southwest Florida that has gotten national attention, that was jam-packed and nobody was wearing a mask. Now, if you're an employee of that business and you're afraid for catching COVID, but you have to go to work anyway, you can't say that the business didn't do anything wrong. They know that they should be requiring masks. and they have all the power. Why is it fair for them to be completely off the hook if somebody brings COVID home to their families or they themselves contract the virus and have serious outcomes? So, you know, that's just another thing that we're looking at. We're looking at major legislation having to do with school choice. And this is really like the biggest blow in this push to privatize public education. That proposal is moving. And people can't get here. We don't see the committee rooms, you know, full of parents and educators and policymakers, you know, weighing in. And so COVID has become, you know, kind of an excuse to put up insulation around the process to keep people out. The protocols that have been developed about COVID and the legislative process, they're doing a great job of protecting the Capitol, but they're doing a lousy job of protecting democracy. And, you know, that's a big issue. And a lot of groups are looking at, you know, how do we combat this? And then the funny thing is my office is right here, right downtown, right in the middle of the Capitol campus or the extended Capitol campus. And each night, they're having outdoor fundraisers with drinks and hors d'oeuvres, and nobody's wearing masks. And so we're really in an interesting time right now. And I'm hopeful that there's going to be some push to really democratize this process during the age of COVID and do things a little better.
Rich,
a lot better.
Rich Templin, thanks a lot for coming on WMNF, and we'll talk to you again as the session heats up.
Yes, sir. Thank you so much. It's always great to talk to you.
That's Rich Templin, who is a spokesperson for the Florida AFL-CIO. He's based in Tallahassee. And if you want to comment about anything that Rich has told us the last 25 minutes or so, you can email us in the studio. The address is dj@wmnf.org, or you can call us at 813-239-9663. Let's go to Ken, who's in Tampa, who's been holding for a while, called early in the show. Ken, thanks for coming on. What would you like to say?
Hey, Rob, happy Friday to you, first of all.
Happy Friday to you.
Second of all, I know Dr. Templin and his passion for what he does, whether through education of the public or advocating for behalf of working people in Florida. Matter of fact, across the country. But dovetailing onto what Rich had to say, currently in Tampa, City of Tampa, we're working on an apprenticeship ordinance, and we're also working on apprenticeship ordinance for Hillsborough County, and we hope to be successful with both of those components to give people an opportunity to earn a trade or career degree through apprenticeship programs and a pathway to the middle class. So I think that ties right into a $15 wage threshold and above, including benefits, health care, and so forth, so they won't have to rely on their community offerings or state subsidies or federal subsidies.
And so Ken, you're with the Teamsters Union, aren't you?
I am with the Teamsters.
Okay. So tell us what an apprenticeship program is and what it would provide for folks that decide, for instance, not to go to college.
Well, my understanding, since we don't currently have a registered state registered apprenticeship program in our local here in Tampa, but we're looking for a state registered apprenticeship program. And in those programs, there's classroom component that the apprentice would participate in and then go work in the field. And then upon reaching their plateau or their goal of apprenticeship, then be certified and jump right into the workforce. So it's a earn and learn type program that the building trades currently offers.
So if you wanted to learn a skill like welding or becoming an electrician or a pipe fitter, or if you want to do carpentry or some other aspect of construction, and let's say you decide that you weren't going to go to college, this would open up that door for you in Hillsborough and in the city of Tampa.
A pathway to success. We know that not everybody is geared for college, but everybody needs to earn a living. And you've heard in recent years that many legislators have adopted STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. I think we should just broaden that to STEAM, science, technology, engineering, apprenticeship, and math.
Well, and in some cases, I mean, if you're, I remember a few years ago hearing that there was huge demand for trades like welders, and that we didn't have enough people here in the Tampa Bay area and Sarasota, Manatee County, for instance, to fill the number of welders that were in demand.
And my personal opinion in with regards to that, if we grow it local, we build it local, and we keep it local. There's many employers that are willing to hire or import workers, which is fine, but why can't we do that within our own community?
Yeah, yeah. So
legislators you talk to, they'll say, you know, my constituents need jobs.
Yeah.
Learn and learn.
Yeah, so Ken, how can people have input to the Tampa City Council and the Hillsborough County Commission on this issue?
Well, there's a Raise the Bar initiative. It's similar to the apprenticeship program Raise the Bar in Pinellas County, that the city of St. Petersburg had adopted. And another component to this is what's known as the MC3 model. I'm not real versed on it, but it is a pre-apprenticeship type program in the public schools to where a student could participate in a pre-apprenticeship program and upon graduation from high school, move right into the apprenticeship program and just keep on earning and learning.
And when you're an electrician and you go through an apprenticeship program, you really know your stuff.
It's who you trust to do the work for you, right? Somebody that's certified. We can always find somebody to tinker with wires or plumbing or painting, but it's somebody that has the skilled trades. And currently, I'm told that nationwide, only 3% of trades and crafts have women in that program doing those type of trades. And I think that we can increase that blueprint for women in the trades and also raise Hillsborough County's equity profile, because all those variables play into the equity profile of a community. And I just think we can raise the bar for the individuals in our city, county, and the extended areas, because a lot of people will travel to their job.
Yeah. Well, Ken, we'll have to pay more attention to this. So thank you for raising the issue.
Well, thank you, and thank you for what you do, Rob. I was your UPS driver in 1985.
So you used to stop by M&F a lot. All right, Ken, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Rob.
All right, great to talk to you. Well, if you want to comment about anything you've heard here so far, I've got a few more ideas I want to bring up. And our phone number is 813-239-9663. Several emails have come in. Lou in Plant City says, in Florida, there's almost no such thing as an ex-felon unless one has had their conviction overturned. They are a felon forever and, as such, have almost no rights. Thanks. The living wage schedule is already behind what's needed to survive. Good topic today, writes Lou in Plant City. And then DeMarco writes, not paying ex-cons a living wage is the stupidest thing I've ever heard. After felons have paid their debt to society, they should be welcomed back into society. Efforts to stigmatize ex-cons and impoverish them continue to punish them after they have paid their debt to society. It's counterproductive, unless your goal is to keep our jails full, writes DeMarco. Let's go to Fred in St. Pete. Fred, thank you for calling. What would you like to say?
Good morning to you, Rob.
Good morning.
I heard the very beginning of your interview. I know it was recorded. And I missed the last maybe 15 minutes. So I don't know if you asked him this question or not. But my question is, if the voters passed the bill to raise the minimum wage to $15. I don't remember any exceptions in that we voted on. Do you?
According to Rich, there were no exceptions. So it didn't say if you're an ex-felon, you can be paid $7 an hour, $8 an hour. It said it applied to everybody.
My big question is, how does the legislature have the right, once the voters have passed this thing, to go in there and tinker around and and put exceptions to it. How do they have the right to do that if the voters already passed it without these exceptions?
Well, they've done that many times, and keep in mind, it's just a proposal from Senator Brandis. He's proposing bring this issue up again and put it on the ballot. So it hasn't passed the legislature. It's his proposal, and as my guest said, as Rich said, there's some pushback in Tallahassee. Not everybody is on board with Senator Brandis's idea.
Well, I hope not, but knowing the history of our legislature currently, I can see something like that. They always want to tinker with
they
things.
They always do. They always think that they know best in Tallahassee.
And I wonder why we even vote on anything if they can turn around and start making exceptions to it. You know, that bothers me. That was the reason of my call to you this morning, Rob. It was a great conversation, and I appreciate your having it on.
All right, Fred, thanks a lot. Thank you for that. Again, our phone number is 813-239-9663. And Cindy Philpott is our phone producer today. Brian writes in to say, I heard your reporting that the Republican State Senator Rodriguez and his Republican cohorts are about to eliminate the pension plan for new employees and how this will likely kill the pension system for retirees. How can any state worker ever vote Republican? The Republican Party is hell-bent on doing away with pension plans nationwide just as they want to eliminate Social Security. This is beyond insane. And workers and voters are letting this happen, writes Brian in West Tampa. Brian, thank you. Thank you for your email. And then, let's see. Let's go to Danny in Tampa. Danny, thank you for calling. What would you like to say?
Good morning, Rob. Just wanted to say that just a little while ago, I saw Marjorie Taylor Greene. She was giving a press conference. It was on Fox. And let's just say now that, in my opinion, I think this is the new Donald Trump. She is out there just acting just like Donald Trump, arrogant and defiant. They asked her a question about what she had said yesterday, if she still, you know, regrets what she said. Did you not hear my press conference yesterday? Did you not hear what I said yesterday? That's exactly the same treatment you all gave President Trump when you asked him about white supremacy, on and on and on. And so, therefore, she's just as arrogant as ever. This morning, she got—I don't know if you saw the tweet she said this morning. She said how stupid the Democrats are, how dumb they are to give somebody like me free time to talk. You know, now this woman is 199 Republicans, Rob, voted for her, Rob. So therefore, they want to sit there and say that this is the face that they have chosen, the Donald Trump face of the Republican Party, you know, to go along, Rob. So this is very telling. And, you know, Rob, let me leave you with this. I didn't see this till yesterday. I did not know this. Did you ever see the picture of her with that AR-15?
I did. It's pretty famous. And Steny Hoyer put it up yesterday when he was speaking on the House floor.
Who was terrific. Rob, what does that tell you about this woman? And this woman shouldn't be off committees. She should be, like Anna Navarro said, in Bellevue, in my opinion.
All right, Danny, thanks a lot. Thanks for your thoughts.
Rob.
All right, so perhaps you saw that photo where this congresswoman from North Georgia is holding an AR-15, and she's pointing it forward. And then and she's on the right side of the photo. On the left side of the photo are the three members of the squad. Who are progressive members of the U.S. House of Representatives. And it looks like she's threatening the members of Congress. Well, speaking of that, let's listen to a report from the Associated Press. As Danny said, yesterday, the House, which was fiercely divided, 199 members of Congress thought she should keep her committee assignments, but a divided House tossed Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene off both of her committee assignments. It was unprecedented, and it was punishment. It reflected the Democrats' outrage at the hateful and violent conspiracy theories that Congresswoman Greene has helped spread. Let's listen to a story from the Associated Press.
It's an unprecedented punishment, which came after Greene took the House floor in her own defense to address her social media posts, which questioned 9/11 and school shootings and embraced violence against Democrats.
These were words of the past, and these things do not represent me.
Green says she regrets that. Democrat Debbie Wasserman Schultz didn't buy it.
A deathbed, mild walk back of a couple of wild conspiracy theories just moments ago is not enough to prevent her future harm.
Every Democrat voted to yank Green off two committees. Nearly all Republicans voted no. Sagar Magani, Washington.
And that vote happened last night. Let's take some more phone calls. By the way, our phone number is 813-239-9663. Let's go to Mike in Brandon. Hi, Mike. You're on M&F.
Hey, Rob. As far as Green, it's more a reflection of the failure of the Republican leadership. McCarthy, he's just, I know he's in a pickle with the base. He's walking a fine line. But at the end of the day, he could have prevented all that show. And for political reasons, he chose not to. Much as what's been going on for the last 4 years, the Republican senior leadership, they're strategically looking at how they can get their votes and who they can afford to offend and whatnot. But going back to your caller, the gentleman you were speaking with now, I never mentioned before, but I'm a licensed engineering officer. I'm with a union. I'm with MEBA, one of the few officer unions in the United States for shipping. And, you know, he was talking about the defined benefit. And we were at a crossroads about 7 or 8 years ago where the various companies that we work for, they wanted to scrap it. It was a opportunistic time for them right after the financial crisis. And our leadership was able to save it. And I hate to think that most people really don't understand what a defined benefit is, how incredibly, incredibly valuable it is. Because converting over to the defined contribution or the 401k complements of the tax code, most people are never going to retire. They will never be able to save enough money where their investment will not erode their principal. And I think it's one of the greatest scams going on currently. The only other thing I would add to this is our organization, you know, when we compete for work, which I'm going to be doing in a couple of weeks, actually next week I'm going to compete for work, here's the beauty of my profession or my organization. It doesn't matter what your sex is, doesn't matter what your creed is, none of that matters. You compete for the work, you get it, everyone gets paid the same. You're a third assistant engineer, here's what your base pay, here's what your overtime rate, here's your various benefits, medical, dental, so forth. It is incredibly fair. And for women, especially, you know, because you've heard, as have I, that most women are receiving some percentage below a dollar compared to males. So in that sense, it's very fair. And we do have our organization. We don't really have an apprenticeship program, but there is a unlicensed organization that does. And for approximately 9 months of training with minimum investment, a young person can make $5,000 a month. So there are some really good opportunities. And I often, every year when they do the Great American Teach-In, if I can, I will go and do a presentation, and I will, you know, present my organization, you know, kind of give them an idea, because there is a systematic undermining of unions and what unions mean.
There's no doubt about it. Mike, thanks a lot. Thank you for that. All right, good to hear from you. You know, if you're forced into a 401k and you no longer get, let's say that your pension right now, your defined benefit pension, is $1,000 a month. But let's say for the new employee, they're put over into a 401k. And let's say that you save $2,000 or $200,000 over your work life. You'll probably save more, but let's just start at $200,000. You're supposed to take out about 4% a year. So 4% of $200,000 is about $8,000 a year. And that's what you're supposed to live on along with your Social Security if you get Social Security. But what happens if the stock market goes down and corrects? What if happens if the stock market goes from the value of your investments being $200,000, let's say it takes a 20% dip, So now it's down to 180,000, and you're supposed to take 4% of that 180,000. Or it goes down to 160,000 rather. And you're supposed to live on 4% of $160,000 now. So what does that do? With a defined benefit pension, you know that you've got a certain amount, and it's going to go up slightly every year with probably with inflation. But that's the way it works now. But the proposal is to put all new state employees into a 401k beginning next year. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Our email address, dj@wmnf.org. There's so many important stories, but I wanted to mention this one before we go back to the phones. A South Florida-based voting technology company is now suing Fox News and three of its top personalities on the air, along with attorney Rudy Giuliani and attorney Sidney Powell, for $2.7 billion, saying that the defendants conspired to spread false claims that the voting company helped to steal the presidential election. This could be very big. Let's listen to a short report from the AP.
Florida-based Smartmatic USA has filed one of the largest libel suits ever undertaken. The company is asking for $2.7 billion from Fox News, three of its hosts, and two former lawyers for former President Trump, Rudy Giuliani and Sidney Powell. According to the complaint, Fox News aired at least 13 reports stating or implying that the company stole the 2020 election in cahoots with Venezuela's socialist government. Fox News Media said it's proud of its election coverage and would defend itself against what it described as a meritless lawsuit. Dominion Voting Systems, a rival election technology company used in 24 states, has also sued Giuliani and Powell for $1.3 billion. I'm Jennifer King.
All right, so if you haven't already read the print version of that story, go look at it, because Jennifer did a really good job there of kind of giving us the highlights. But there is so much more to that story. And take a look at it. Read the print version. I really urge you to do that. Ernie writes in to say, regarding Congresswoman Green and the AR-15, I can safely say that none of us who carried a weapon similar to this in combat in Vietnam would pose with it in such a manner, writes Ernie in Port Richey. Let's go to Greg in Clearwater. Greg, thank you for calling Radioactivity. You're on. What would you like to say?
Hey, I was just wondering, do you guys ever cover any of the hypocrisy that the Democratic side of the government does on a daily basis? I was just curious.
I just asked Rich Templin whether or not the Democratic Party was anti-union. How about that for today, for starters? Is that good enough for you?
Good job. How about Schuster sitting up there pointing at buildings and saying, this is what we need to fight the attack, and yet...
I'm sorry, I didn't understand what you said. Who's pointing at a building?
What was his name? Schuster? I can't remember the...
Schuster.
The,
somebody's pointing at a building. And what did they say? What's the crime?
Idiot. Now you're trying to belittle me.
No, I'm not trying to belittle you. Is somebody named Schuster pointed at a building. What did they say?
You know what? You guys are so hypocritical. It's ridiculous.
Greg, I don't think that name calling helps. If you want to bring up an issue, somebody named Schuster was pointing at a building. You know, call back when you get your thoughts together, and I'll put you on. Let's go to Clyde in Temple Terrace. Clyde, thank you for calling. What would you like to say?
Hi. I just wanted to comment on the defined pension benefit versus 401k, and in connection with the union and the maritime unions, which are some of the best unions out there. It in my mind, it comes down to how much does an employer contribute to a plan, and not really what kind of plan it is. Both the 401ks and the defined benefit plans are highly expensive, and all kinds of money is going to investment advisors that are basically doing nothing. And if employers contributed the same amount of money that they're contributing to a defined pension plan, and it went into some kind of a vehicle that the employee could manage themselves without a 401k also raking in a bunch of money for investment advisors that are basically doing nothing, and in a lot of cases putting people into high fee mutual fund. So it's to me, it's both vehicles are expensive and flawed, and it really comes down to the amount of money. So the maritime unions, they're contributing all kinds of money into this defined pension plan, but the employee would be better off if that same amount of money was in a fund.
Okay. And Clyde, I'm not trying to cut you off. We're out of time. But Clyde, thanks a lot for making your point. If you want to comment about today's show, call us 813-238-8001. Record your comment on extension 115. This is WMNF in Tampa.